You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Allison Sing Ji seemed to have it all after she landed a job as features editor in the Hong Kong offices of Asia Week. Exciting work, a wealthy and well-connected British boyfriend, and a closet full of cocktail dresses and Jimmy Choo stilettos she could wear when she went clubbing every night. But as she explains in her memoir, Where the Peacocks Sing, she gave up her lavish lifestyle for love when she met Ajay Singh, a colleague from India who was content to live simply on his journalist's wages, only to learn 6 months into their courtship that Ajay was a prince whose family owned a 100-room palace in India. Her book is published by St. Martin's Press, and I'm very pleased that it brings Allison Sing Ji to our show today. Hello. Should I be pronouncing his name Ajay or Ajay?
He always describes it as a blue jay, so a jay.
Okay. Your story sounds like a modern-day fairy tale. Is that how you see it?
Oh, that's a great question, Leonard. Actually, in a sense, it is a fairy tale until you read the fine print.
Well, it doesn't sound like it's the kind of story that does have a happy ending. And it started off, you say, with the desire to visit India. You'd had that ever since a relative had given you a snow globe of the Taj Mahal.
That's right. You know, I actually didn't realize how much India had seized hold of my imagination until I started writing this book and I had fallen in love with someone from India. And then I started to mine my memories and realized that India had always been part of my deep loves and desires.
Is that typical of somebody who's growing up Chinese American?
Absolutely not.
Your story did take place some time ago. You and Ajay were married in 1999. You have a 10-year-old daughter. And I mentioned Happily Ever After. Is it a Happily Ever After story as far as you're concerned?
Well, Leonard, that's so funny because that's where the fine print does come in. Because it's all wonderful to marry someone who grew up in a palace. But as you know, the palace was built in 1911 and hasn't been modernized since. So there are more mosquitoes than servants. There's a lot of mold on the walls. There's no electricity. And so that's where the fine print comes in, as well as daily life with a husband who's always grown up with servants.
And that's why you live in Los Angeles and don't have an Indian version of Downton Abbey?
That's very funny. I think you got that right. Our house in Los Angeles is a lovely little house, but it's nothing like Buckingham Palace or even Mokimpur.
Now, you grew up in a Chinese-American family in Los Angeles. How did you wind up living in Hong Kong?
Great question. I always like to say that I moved to Hong Kong to get away from Chinese people, and that is namely my very chaotic family. I grew up with, you know, 5 siblings, a really brilliant but slightly nutty, well, not even slightly, he was nutty dad. And by the time I'd reached my 20s, I really realized that I needed to break away from this family in order to really understand myself. So that's when I left for Hong Kong. And it allowed me to see the dimensions of what being Chinese and Chinese American could bring.
Well, you also, your family struggled economically, you never had enough money. You were the poor relatives?
Yes, it was really quite a polarizing experience. On one hand, my father grew up with a lot of money, and one whole part of our family had beautiful houses, beautiful cars, everything they could dream of. And then there was us. I mean, looking back, we had a lot of richness, incredible richness in our life. We were always traveling. We were always exposed to the arts. But at the same time, yeah, it was 6 kids squabbling over 8 pieces of pizza.
And usually often when that is the background, people do everything possible to make a lot of money because they don't want to have to experience that further into their lives and put their kids to that sort of thing.
Yes, I guess that's where the schizophrenia came in again, because I think because we were exposed to so much wealth when I was growing up, that was our expectation.
And you write honestly in this book about how tough it was for you to give up the jet set lifestyle that your wealthy boyfriend had helped provide you when you were in Hong Kong. When you fell in love with a Jay, was it difficult for you to write about that? Because did you worry that you might come across as a bit shallow?
Absolutely. And I think at the beginning of the book, I do come off as value challenged. But I think when people connect the dots between where I was as a person in Hong Kong and how those values were shaped when I was a child and what I how I developed once I start this journey with Ajay, I hope they empathize and I hope they themselves realize what kind of decisions they can make in their own life.
How did you and Ajay first meet?
That's a great question. I still remember the day. We, at Asia Week, my editor decided we needed a big offsite. So she called in all the correspondents from all over Asia. And I'd worked with all of them over the phone. And I had worked with Ajay many times. In fact, once he flubbed a deadline and I got very angry with him. And I just remember that he had the sweetest voice, even as I was gently berating him about having missed a deadline. So he came into the office and a friend of ours said, "Allison, meet Ajay." And I tell people it was like that moment in West Side Story where Tony meets Maria and the whole world falls away. But to get away from cliches, for me, it was more a matter of cellular recognition where I saw him and I saw my destiny float into my life.
Really? I mean, this is a pretty powerful thing you're saying, just because some guy walked into the office?
Well, you know, I think if you believe in the spirit and in destiny and in the world trying to make connections for you, then it really does make sense.
But then he had to go back to India. How long were you able to stay together? Did you stay together? You were living with somebody else.
Oh, yes. And that's where I don't come off looking very good. I actually, Ajay and I never had a date, never kissed. We touched hands once. It was more that we had agreed to be friends. There was no discussion of romance, just a discussion of lives. And I actually made the decision to say goodbye to my boyfriend at the time, Nigel, and to see where this relationship would lead me. And so we kept in touch via company email, just as friends.
And how often did you write to each other?
At least once a day.
Mm-hmm. So you talked about a lot of things, and it's surprising that Ajay never mentioned in his letters that he belonged to a royal family and that he was heir to a 100-room palace.
No, never. He talked about his travels across India, and he talked about his journalistic coups and how much he loved Hong Kong and Japan, but never about being landed gentry.
Did he ever tell you why he kept that a secret?
Well, he's a very humble person, and he doesn't think that such trappings really matter. So I think he felt it just didn't matter.
So had you left Nigel when Ajay wrote to you that he'd fallen in love with you and was moving to Hong Kong to be with you?
That's a really great question. I actually had made the decision that because when someone new enters your life, even as a friend, it makes you question the relationships you're in. And at that point, I had made a decision that I would move on with my life by myself or with somebody new.
Did Ajay's declaration of love take you by surprise?
It did. I was hoping that our relationship at some point would blossom, but of course I was thrilled. I got the email. I still remember the morning. I walked into my office at Asia Week and saw the subject line, which was, "Please sit down as you read this." So that's exactly what I did. And when I read it, I was absolutely floored and silent for at least an hour.
Now, what were you doing at Asia Week? You were editing?
I was an editor. I was a features editor. So I would edit these wonderful stories, challenging stories from all over Asia.
But I can't imagine that you were very highly paid. When you leave somebody who has a lot of money, you have to find a place of your own. You suddenly are moving down in status, aren't you?
Well, you know, that was really quite life-changing. I think since college, I had always been able to live quite well, whether through my job or through the circles I moved with. A lot of friends were very generous. Come meet me at my club or come join me for dinner. So I always felt I had a rich life. And I think.
But didn't they also think you'd made a terrible mistake leaving Nigel for this poor guy from India?
Absolutely terrible mistake. Yes, they thought I was crazy, that it was a coup de foudre, basically, that I needed to be shaken up a bit.
Did it help when you learned later that there was this palace in India? Could you tell them about it?
Very funny. It was sort of like the Princess and the Pea type story, where when I met Ajay, I sensed a certain refinement in him that made me love him. And having come from a family where we had a lot of graces in a lot of ways and understood the beauty in life, I think what I recognized was a kindred spirit.
Well, you had moved to an unfashionable part of Hong Kong, across the street from a fish store, the very opposite of a palace. How did you learn about the palace, finally?
Well, as you say, my physical circumstances had really changed. We had moved to the quote-unquote Chinese side of town, and things were noisy and dirty and crowded there. But I was really enjoying the adventure, even though my friends were no longer interested in visiting me. I brought Ajay home to meet my family in Los Angeles, and I left him on the patio with my mother. And I left for a bit. I came back, and I saw her smiling. Her eyes were just slits of glee. And I remember hearing her say, "Well, 100 rooms, that's an awfully big house." And I said, "What's 100 rooms?" And Ajay cleared his throat, and he said, "The family house I grew up in." And I said, "Well, that sounds kind of big." And he said, "Well, it's like a small palace."
But the family didn't have the kind of money to keep it up. You describe it as mosquito infested. You said they didn't have indoor plumbing.
Well, sadly, you know how these landed gentry families can go.
Yeah, I've seen those Satyajit Ray movies.
That's very funny. There's often one illustrious ancestor who manages to build a grand empire, and then everyone in between sort of slips a notch. And so we were several notches down the ladder at that point.
So you did well when you introduced him to your family, but what happened when he introduced you to his family?
Oh, goodness. All hell broke loose. Well, first of all, Ajay was quite late in getting married because he was very stubborn and very progressive and wanted to marry for love. So he was well into his 30s by then. And on one hand, they were happy just that I was, I was breathing and had two eyes. But on the other hand, here was this nutty Chinese-American journalist who wore funny shoes and didn't know how to cook.
And committed terrible faux pas. You cooked them a traditional Chinese dinner of roast duck, not realizing that they were vegetarians.
I made a lot of dumb mistakes, that's for sure.
So did you learn how to cook in the Indian style?
I wouldn't say learn how to cook. I would say that I had a lot of arrogance and tried very hard to make something delicious. I ultimately pulled off a meal that didn't poison or kill anybody.
But aren't you now thinking about doing an Indian cookbook?
Great question. Actually, my next book, which I am presently working on, is called Cooking for the Maharani, 4 Continents, 6 Iconic Chefs, and 1 Tall Glass of Revenge. And I am going around the world working with iconic chefs and learning how to cook. My hope is to make 7 nights of feasts for my mother-in-law, and my hope is that at the end of it, she will not have succumbed to any major illnesses.
Now, so far the book, we've been talking about the funny side of it, but you've included some interesting observations about India's caste system in the book. Weren't you surprised when you first arrived at how the Singhs treated their longtime servant, Ho Ti Lang?
Great question. That was a really poignant discovery. We had had contact with a lot of servants in Hong Kong, helpers and maids and cleaners, but servant life in India took human relationships to a different level. I was really shocked at how delineated experiences were in India, and they did treat their servants very, very well, even giving them plots of land so they could sustain themselves in the future. So I feel that the Singhs, as landed gentry, were of the highest level of kindness.
Well, he slept on the floor on a mat. Well, and they didn't talk to him for a while because he put butter on a sandwich that they took to a picnic. But we're not going to get into that anymore because we've run out of time. My great thanks to Alison Singh G. Her book, Where the Peacocks Sing, it's very funny, actually. Subtitled A Palace, A Prince, and the Search for Home. It's published by St. Martin's Press. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Leonard.